ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Selena Green with you for The Country Hour on this Anzac Day. Thank you for your company. What does an impending live sheep export ban mean for South Australia? We'll take a look at that in a moment. And if you're a grain producer, how optimistic are you feeling about your industry right now? Well, the results of a major producer survey are out today. I'll delve into them shortly. If you want to join me, the numbers are the same as usual, 1300 222 891. That's my talkback number, or the text line at 0467 922 891. But first, the federal Labor government has committed to phasing out live sheep exports from Australia by sea. And while that is yet to happen, the policy is already, as we're seeing, having a huge impact on the industry. Holly Ludeman is a WA-based managing director of industry group, the Livestock Collective. She's also a vet, corporate governance and compliance officer for Emmanuel Exports. Well, Dr. Ludeman travelled to Mount Gambier last night for a forum with local sheep producers that was organised by the local Liberal Party. I had her in the studio and asked her if the end of the live export trade was something that was concerning the industry here.
Yeah, I think it was important to talk to South Australian producers last night and for them to understand they're not immune to the impacts of the policy that's going on. I actually loaded some of the last boats out of South Australia 10 years ago working as a veterinarian, and the Adelaide port and the feedlot here were important parts of your livestock trade at certain times in the past, and it's critical to most of Western Australia's livestock industry.
So what do you see as flow-on consequences of a ban like this for South Australian producers?
Well, we're seeing at the moment the bottleneck of sheep moving from west to east, and at times that's been excellent relief valve. And in 2020, we saw the break of the drought and lots of ewes and positive movements coming from west to east. And now we're seeing the results of a, you know, terrible season in Western Australia and a critical need to move sheep for welfare reasons.
Paint a picture of what it is like for WA sheep producers at the moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty that's been created over the last 5 years of regulatory change, political uncertainty. That's not created an environment for people to want to invest or want to stay in sheep, and really difficult for our farming families and communities. We're seeing that bottleneck at the moment, and the critical nature of feed and water supply has led to, you know, 21% decrease year-on-year of ram purchases. People are not joining or doing really short joining periods. You know, possibly seeing a 30% reduction in lambs available for the 24-25 season, and that extremely poor season will impact lamb survival rates and health and welfare on farm. Those water and feed reserves will impact whether people stay in sheep. Mm. And we've seen that with the over 300,000 sheep that have moved from west to east in the last 3 months.
So what has demand been like for live exports? I mean, is there still a high demand? Where's it coming from?
Yeah, it was great to talk last night to producers about the industry statistics internationally. And there's demand for 25 million sheep. Saudi Arabia alone takes 5 million sheep and goats annually. So there is a lot of international demand. It's hard to turn the tap back on with vessels and logistics and manage Australian regulatory requirements. We're definitely not operating on an international level playing field. Australia does have the highest standards in the world, but that also comes with the highest cost of exporting. So we've got, you know, the challenge of being internationally competitive with those regulatory requirements. And now we're not shipping for 3 months of the year as well. That consistent supply can impact our trading relationships. So there has been consistent exports, and we've actually seen 2023 live export numbers are up, and it would be great to increase those even further.
Do you think that there is a possible case? It has been sort of floated, you know, obviously aside government policy, but if the live trade was to continue, a possible case for a return of shipments going out of Adelaide?
Oh, absolutely. I think when the supply and demand worked, and there were certain times of the season where shipments out of Adelaide were excellent. So times like May or June or July, when our season had broke but you had sheep available, that the ships would come here and do part shipments, maybe 30-40% of the shipment would come from Adelaide, and then they would go fill up from Western Australia. So historically there was always that, you know, eastern impact on the trade, and I think over the last 5 years it's, you know, really become solely West Australian.
So with the live export ban, if this is something is to go ahead, obviously the government has flagged that that's its intention, though we don't have a date of exactly if and how that would apply. Why can't those sheep and cattle, why can't they be slaughtered and processed onshore? What's stopping a transfer to full onshore processing?
Yeah, it's a really interesting comment that I think is misinformed. It's not as simple as replace live with chilled or frozen. The market options of live, chilled and frozen have worked synergistically for many years. Our access to markets like Saudi started with us first having live in those markets. Then that developed the trust and we had chilled and frozen. And we are not always competing with each other. They work together. In Western Australia, for example, live allows the processors to then have consistent supply all year round. Processors sometimes struggle with supply in Western Australia. It's also our chilled supply chains, our, you know, market access doesn't always allow just to rapidly increase chilled or frozen. And let's be honest here, which I've said before, these aren't Australian jobs or Australian people necessarily working in our processing plants. So I think that notion of replacing one with the other is a farce. And to have a strong sheep industry in Western Australia, we need both industries to work alongside each other.
What about public support? Has the live trade lost its social licence, its support amongst the Australian public?
I talked a bit about that again last night at the forum around community sentiment, and yeah, while the minister may have, and the current government's policy is phasing out live sheep because of concerns with the industry, I think as a veterinarian who's worked in the industry for 10 years, I've seen the rapid and exponential improvements on board. We've had increased space available. We have ventilation systems which have modernised and being independently audited. We're seeing the best outcomes from voyages, and the importing markets are loving the quality of livestock arriving. Mortality rates, which is one measure of health and welfare, which is objective, are at an all-time low. So they're comparable, if not better, to on-farm mortality rates. And morbidity rates, so health and welfare, how the animal's coping in the environment. I showed some videos last night of animals sitting down. They can all sit down at once, access to feed and water, and that they're getting off in better condition than they got on. So I don't understand the policy anymore. It doesn't reflect the industry we have today or the excellent outcomes that we're getting that's providing food security to our trading partners.
Is that, though, something that still needs to continue? Does that continue to need to be work on improving even further those animal welfare standards?
I think we've gone pretty far, possibly above some of our domestic requirements. So, but I'm always up for research and development, constant improvement in any intensive agricultural industry. And live export has been used by activists and as a political football. And the policy doesn't reflect the current practices and the excellent outcomes we're getting.
If this does go ahead, we see a ban on live exports, what do you see will be needed to offset some of the impacts in terms of supporting the industry, assisting farmers to, you know, find other markets, to move on to perhaps, you know, other forms of farming, both, I guess, financially and mentally as well, for supporting those in the industry?
I think the policy needs to be reversed. That's the only response that I can give to that. And the WA sheep industry is currently reacting as many predicted it would because of the uncertainty. The minister appointed a phase-out panel who provided a report to him in 2023, and over 1,000 growers engaged with that phase-out panel to talk about what the timeframe should be and what the sheep industry needed in Western Australia. And that report has not been released and the uncertainty has continued. And that uncertainty is our shearing teams, is our trucking companies, is our rural communities and the fabric of the people that make those communities up. Not releasing this policy and leaving people in this constant uncertainty is irresponsible.
Dr. Holly Ludeman there, who's Managing Director of the industry group, the Livestock Collective. Well, the RSPCA continues to call for Australia's live export trade to be stopped. Here's some of what their Chief Science Officer, Dr. Susie Fowler, had to say.
We know that over 70% of the Australian public support the government's policy to phase out live sheep exports. I think the really critical part about the RSPCA's question is that the public support a phase out if as long as the farmers are well supported through the transition, and that's what we've been calling for and speaking to the government about is hopefully soon to announce what that transition might look like. Despite the regulation and the fact that they've stopped shipping animals during the Northern Hemisphere summer, the animals and the vessels still have to go through the equator and still go through areas where the temperature and humidity escalates to sort of over 30 to 33 degrees where we know sheep suffer from heat stress. The science really tells us that's one of the inherent problems with the live sheep export trade is that these animals that are acclimatised to the Australian climate, where it might be hot but nowhere near as humid, don't cope very well in those conditions during the live sheep export voyage. We definitely still have concerns and that's why we're calling for a phase out. And the welfare risks to the sheep go well beyond just the heat stress as well. These sheep have to be handled multiple times and most farmers would agree that one of the most stressful times for sheep is when they're handled and being loaded and unloaded onto trucks and things like that. That has to happen multiple times during a live sheep export journey. And then the voyage on the ship itself is obviously quite stressful. They're being stocked to fairly high densities. They have to transition to a type of feed that they're not used to. They're standing in their own waste during the entire journey. So, you know, those welfare impacts just accumulate over the entire journey. And then when they arrive at the other end, they're being slaughtered. So if all of that can happen here in Australia with a lot less stress to the animal, then that's what we should be transitioning to.
That's RSPCA Australia's Dr. Susie Fowler. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. It's just going 17 minutes past 12. Well, are you going through the process of succession on your farm at the moment? If so, you're far from alone. A survey of around 300 grain producers across the state found many are in the process of handing over the reins. The annual South Australian Grain Producer Survey Insight Report also showed some pretty positive thinking about the future of the industry. Brad Perry is GPSA's Chief Executive Officer. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be here, Selena.
There's some great stats I could cherry pick out of these results of your survey. One of the really interesting ones, though, is just the number of grain operations going through succession at the moment. Fair to say a real transition period for the industry?
Yeah, look, I think the results of the survey, firstly, are really, really good to have such a big response. So we had 300 grain producers fill out the survey. And what we found, somewhat surprisingly, is that a lot of those businesses are actually going through succession and not just transferring that over to family, so sons or daughters, but a lot of them are leasing or share farming. So they're sort of transitioning out of the business altogether in some cases and others staying in it, but someone else is putting the crop in. And that seems to be growing year on year. So I think we've got some opportunities and challenges with that. But that's certainly something that we need to keep in the back of our mind as the grain industry in South Australia.
Yeah, so around a third going through a succession process. What are, I guess, some of the challenges and opportunities that it does to present to have that much turnover going in the industry?
Oh, look, when you do go through succession, you obviously lose, you can lose some experienced people in the industry, you know, people that have been through hard times and good times, but, you know, have adapted their business and have got those forward plans in place. So you do lose that experience, but also I think often there's that younger generation coming in who have grown up with technology and everything seems to be geared towards using technology to increase productivity today. So I think there's opportunities there to get more technology adoption on farm through those younger generations coming through. I think also, you know, there's opportunities with other people coming into the industry from outside grain. So, you know, you've got some investors that are coming in and providing a different business input into some of those grain operations. So, look, I think there's plenty to sift through in the survey and particularly on that issue. But succession planning in itself, as we all know and all your listeners know, is not an easy process.
Something that must give some good heart out of these results is that a good percentage of your respondents felt positive and sustainable in terms of their business and positive about the outlook for the grains industry.
Yeah, that's right. So 94% of grain producers feel their business is profitable and sustainable. So, look, I think that's quite obviously a positive figure, but we have come off the back of, you know, 2.5 really good years. So I think, you know, that was probably back to just above average last year, but a couple of big years before that. So it's not a surprising result to say their profit was sustainable, but I think it's really good for the South Australian grain industry. And we also had 76% were positive about the future of the industry as a whole going forward. So I think there's plenty of optimism there. Obviously hard when you're relying on rain from the sky, but you know, we'll continue to do everything we can as a grain industry to put operations in place and ensure that remain as profitable as we can for grain growers.
Speaking of that valuable stuff that comes out of the sky, you've got an increasing number of respondents who are saying that they are prepared for drought, and perhaps some of them a bit better prepared for drought than they would have been last time around.
Yeah, we specifically asked this question, you know, not only because when you look at the history of drought, you know, we probably aren't too far away from one. It's probably closer than further away at the moment. And also the federal and state governments have got a big focus on drought preparedness and resilience. So we want to really understand where grain producers in South Australia sit on that. And 78% said they're better prepared now than they were for last drought. So again, I think that's really positive. You know, and we can't rest our laurels on that. That's something that, you know, we've really got to work on as an industry.
And perhaps no surprise with some of the main challenges that your producers reported, challenges getting staff, increasing costs, connectivity being quite an issue still?
Yeah, look, the high input costs have been year on year in our surveys, continue to be the number one issue. So we had nearly 70% said that was the biggest issue for them. And we're talking about fuel, we're talking about fertiliser, you know, general machinery costs. So just those costs have remained quite high. So that is a concern and will be a concern going forward. But also things, and not surprisingly, there was 40% saying that attracting and retaining staff is still a big challenge for them. And I think if you went out to any region in South Australia, in not only grain, in agriculture, you'd get that response that they're having trouble filling positions or finding skilled workers. And probably the other one that was quite interesting was that nearly 50% don't have reliable connectivity. So that's a big concern, particularly with so much technology required on farm today. And also from a safety point of view, if there's a fire or an accident and you don't have that reliable connectivity to make a call or inform someone, that's really concerning.
Brad Perry, thanks for joining us on the Country Hour this afternoon.
Good to be here. Thanks, Leila.
Brad Perry, CEO of Grain Producers SA, and the full survey report is on their website. Right, let's go to the Mount Compass Market Report now. Elsie Adamo has it for you. Good afternoon, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Selena. With a short week, numbers reduced substantially as agents offered 350 live weight cattle, nearly 700 head down on the previous sale. The usual trade and processor buyers were in attendance and operating on an extremely mixed quality offering, with restockers active on lighter cattle. Calves sold from 100 to 239 cents, as vealer steers sold firm, making from 100 to 321 cents per kilogram. Vealer heifers lifted up to 30 cents per kilogram, making 123 to 300 cents. Yearling steers and heifers gained 15 to 20 cents, with steers selling from 250 to 300 cents, and heifers 230 to 307 cents per kilogram. Manufacturing steers sold 10 cents dearer, as they made from 165 to 280 cents per kilogram. Grown steers sold 10 cents easier, making 205 to 303 cents, with grown heifers selling 10 cents dearer, making 220 to 281 cents per kilogram. Cows of all weights and grades sold 5 to 10 cents easier, as light beef cows sold to 145 cents per kilogram. Medium beef cows sold from 150 to 210 cents, with dairy breeds making 80 to 150 cents per kilogram. Heavy beef cows sold from 165 to 260 cents, as dairy types range from 150 to 170 cents per kilogram. Bulls sold from 180 to 239 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo, filling in for John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks again, Elsie. It is just coming on to 25 minutes past 12, off to the Weather Bureau, where Hannah Marsh awaits as our forecaster today. Hello, Hannah.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Right, well, what is this weather doing across this public holiday?
Well, we started off with a very cold start in parts. It got down to minus 0.2 of a degree at Nurriupa, 1.6 degrees at Clare, 2.3 at Cummins, and 2.5 degrees at Loxton. Since then, we have had the tail end of a trough move over southern parts of the state, and we've seen falls up to 9 a.m. of generally less than 2 millimetres, with the highest being 1.8 at Morphett Vale. Those showers are really about windward coasts and ranges and also the lower southeast. Since 9 a.m, we've had a further less than 1 millimetre, with the highest being 0.6 at Point Avoid. We are expecting these showers activity to continue, particularly near those windward coasts and ranges, for the remainder of the day. Having a look at some of the temperatures that it's been up to so far today, it's been up to 19 degrees at Ceduna, 18 at Port Lincoln and Whyalla, 19 also at Cooper Pedy, 21 at Oodnadatta so far, 17 at Woomera, 16 at Broken Hill so far, 19 at Renmark. It's been up to 19 degrees so far at Murray Bridge, 16 at Clare, only 14 degrees at Mount Lofty, 18 degrees at Hindmarsh Island, 20 at Kingscote, and 16 degrees so far at Mount Gambier. Then as we move into tomorrow, we've got a high pressure system to our south, which will really remain south of the Bight for a few days, resulting in those stable conditions. We'll see minimum temperatures below average again, with some frost patches about the agricultural area. And we'll also see those showers about windward coasts and ranges continuing over the southern agricultural area with those onshore winds. Having a look at some of the temperatures for tomorrow, we're expecting a minimum of 5, maximum of 20 for Ceduna, a maximum of 18 for Port Lincoln, Whyalla, 22 for Cooper Pedy. Tomorrow we'll see 24 at Oodnadatta, 21 at Woomera, 19 with cloud clearing at Broken Hill, a minimum of just 5 degrees and maximum of 19 for Renmark, 19 also at Murray Bridge, getting up to 14 after a minimum of 4 at Clare, 17 with a possible shower for Mount Barker and also for Victor Harbour, looking at 19 at Kingscote and 16 and cloudy tomorrow at Mount Gambier. Then as we head into the weekend, we have the high pressure system move out into the Tasman Sea. And again, we'll see very cold minimum temperatures with areas of frost likely over the agricultural area. And the maximum temperatures will just nudge a little bit closer to average on Saturday and more so on Sunday. But we are looking at mostly dry conditions for both those days. There is just this chance of a spot or two about the lower southeast coast on Saturday. But then as we head into Monday, we do have a front that we're expecting to move over the southern agricultural again, which will see the return of showers to the southern agricultural area, more frequent about the lower southeast windward coasts and ranges. So in terms of cumulative rainfall total up until the end of Monday, we're generally looking at less than 2 millimetres, but possibly 2 to 5 millimetres about the lower southeast.
Thanks for that, Hannah. Great rest of your day.
Thank you. Same to you and your listeners.
Hannah Marsh there from the Weather Bureau. For the western inland parts of New South Wales, looking at tomorrow in the upper western district, expecting a sunny day with southerly winds 15 to 25 k's an hour, becoming light in the evening. Overnight between 7 and 10 degrees and daytime temperatures expected to reach the low to mid 20s. Partly cloudy conditions forecast for the lower western district, light winds becoming southerlies 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning and then light by the evening. Overnight to just around 6 degrees. Daytime temperatures reaching around 20. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. In this next half an hour, well, the Federal Trade Minister has been in South Australia, in the Riverland to be precise, meeting with producers there amid the wine glut. What can be done to help this industry in crisis?
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your company today. Coming up, there is a crisis going on in the Riverland wine industry. The Federal Trade Minister is in the region speaking firsthand with struggling producers. You're going to hear from him shortly. Also, during wartime, food and fibre still needs to be produced. Crops still need to be tended and harvested. Animals cared for and processed. You'll hear from an author whose work has been inspired by the thousands of Australian women who kept the farms running during World War II.
And I thought, if I don't know about the Australian women who gave up their city lives and went to the country, then surely I can't be alone. So that set me off down the rabbit hole of discovering the really important role that these women played in World War II in actually keeping our troops and the country fed.
More on that story coming up. But if your farm's been in the family for some time, who kept it running during times of war? If you've got a story to share today, I'd love to hear it. 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. As I said, more to come, but this is all after news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, tens of thousands of people across SA gathered at the break of dawn today to honour those who served in the Australian military. Many who attended spoke about their personal connection to Anzac Day and how it's easy to forget the effects that war has on the people involved. The Prime Minister has joined a dawn service on the Kokoda Track in Papua New Guinea, promising to never forget the assistance that locals provided to Australian troops during World War II. Anthony Albanese spent the last 2 days hiking part of the Kokoda Track alongside the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, James Marape. And five teenagers have been charged after a series of police raids relating to the stabbing of a bishop and a priest at a church in Sydney's West last week. Yesterday, more than 400 police searched 13 locations in Sydney and Goulburn. The teenagers have been charged with a series of offences, including possessing or controlling violent extremist material obtained or accessed using a carriage service, and conspiring to engage in an act in preparation for or planning a terrorist act. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yes, the Federal Trade Minister, Don Farrell, is in the Riverland to meet with growers and winemakers amid an industry crisis. You'll hear from him shortly, but first, Riverland Wine Executive Officer Lyndall Rowe explained the purpose of these meetings.
We encourage the participants to, you know, foster dialogue, exchange ideas, and, you know, really work together to chart a course towards a sustainable future for the Riverland. So Minister Farrell spoke to both groups about emphasising the need for stabilising the relationship with China, especially concerning trade, which of course is significant for South Australia and particularly so for the wine industry. So despite recent challenges like trade bans on certain products and the impact of COVID-19 lockdowns, I got a real sense that he has optimism for the re-entering of the Chinese market and also exploring other potential markets like India.
What sort of optimism did he have for the China market?
He was pretty clear that he felt optimistic that things would come back. One of those reasons is that the Chinese love Australian wine. One of the things he said was that they have stopped buying in China, you know, red wine products from other countries because they prefer Australian wine. But that doesn't mean to say that China isn't affected by global trends. So definitely data there to suggest that China, like other countries, is moving towards those global trends of drinking less but drinking well.
And, yeah, I guess just circling back to the meetings and having a whole bunch of winemakers and growers in across a series of meetings, you know, what was the sort of mood and sentiment in the room?
I thought it was very positive, actually, and the meetings were very different. So, you know, we got together with the large volume wine producers from, you know, across the region. So there was discussion about moving volume, there was discussion about trade policy and trade support relevant to the wine industry. We also talked about the development of support across the international markets in the post-China opening phase, and that also how best the federal government can support the wine sector in the Riverland and on reasonable projections of the benefit of China reopening, of course.
And yeah, it's been a big deal. A lot of growers and winemakers have said they really want to have federal or state ministers come out and listen to growers and listen to their concerns. You know, how significant is this to have this visit?
I think it's really significant. Minister Farrell did a lot of listening, and so everyone got to raise key concerns. Interestingly, just looking back at the large volume wine producer meeting, you know, there's concern about financial assistance for growers. It's such an important thing. You know, they are the backbone of our industry. We need to look at restructuring support for our region and also how we access alternate markets. It's really crucial for industry sustainability. Key concerns, of course, are over supply issues, pricing competitiveness, and the need for structural reform.
And yes, speaking of commercial wine producers, these discussions come as Accolade Wines, who take in the majority of the region's wine grapes, has put an offer to CCW Cooperative's growers, including an offer to buy out their contracts for $4,000 per hectare. You know, what are some of the thoughts of, I guess, Riverland Wine, or, you know, was this something you were able to raise with the minister, or people were able to raise with the minister?
No, we weren't there to talk about that relationship and so on. It was more an opportunity to look at trade and tourism. So, for example, when we caught up with the minister in the second meeting, we really talked about tourism and development and looking at a diversified base of production in the region and a real need for support in sales growth. But, you know, Riverland Wine will continue to stand with our levy-paying producers, you know, our wine grape growers and our wineries. We're very committed to the well-being and prosperity of our community.
And there's certainly a sense from those involved in the wine industry in the Riverland that, yeah, if you can get visitors to come, whether they're international delegates or, you know, indeed domestic tourists, that they really view what the industry is doing here quite favourably. You know, where did the tourism elements fit in the discussions and what sort of things were discussed there?
We discussed various areas of regional economy, its connection to international markets, particularly focusing on export grants. It's so important to have financial support, particularly with the EMDG grant that the federal government are currently re-evaluating. Strategic engagement with Southeast Asia, the challenges in agriculture and wine, tourism and marketing initiatives. Marketing initiatives was something that was raised a lot and at both meetings as being so important to the region and to build the region's image, not only domestically but globally as well.
That is the Executive Officer of Riverland Wine, Lyndall Rowe, there speaking with Eliza Berlage. Well, as we said, Federal Trade and Tourism Minister Don Farrell is in the Riverland region. He says he's waited until now to visit Australia's largest producing wine region because he was waiting for the good news of China's tariffs being removed. He has been meeting with large commercial wineries and smaller producers to discuss trade opportunities amid the global wine glut. Eliza Berlage caught up with the minister to hear him out about his visit to the Riverland.
Look, I was keen to come up here, Eliza, after we got the good news that the tariffs, the terrible tariffs on Australian wine, had been lifted by the Chinese authorities. And I wanted to make sure that this region, which has been very badly affected by those impediments, got the most advantage out of the reopening of trade to China. Already, 50 companies have sent wine back into China. We've sold more wine to China in the last 2 weeks than we did in the previous 3 years. So I want to give a message of hope, a positive message to the Riverland that at least as far as the surplus of particularly red wine is concerned, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Even if you're not an exporter into China, you'll benefit by other companies getting much of their wine back into the China market. Prior to the bans being imposed, we sold about $1.2 billion worth of wine into China. They were far and away our largest international market, But for South Australia, it was almost $1 billion worth of sales. So South Australia, and of course the Riverland in particular, were very badly affected by those bans. I'm hoping that if what I've seen with other products like barley, like hay, like stone fruits, we can get back into the Chinese market very quickly. My message to the winemakers and the grape growers in the Riverland is stay positive. There is a significant degree of progress, and I'm very hopeful that within a very short space of time, we can recover what we lost in the Chinese market.
Minister, there has been some fears, though, that the Chinese market is just drinking a lot less, maybe drinking a third of what they were drinking before. Is it possible to even try to get to the volumes that we were at?
Look, it's true that the Chinese market has shrunk since the impediments were imposed. But there's a couple of things about that, Eliza. The first thing, of course, is that you had COVID during that period, and for a lot of the Chinese consumers, the way they consume wine is out at restaurants, as gifts. None of that was happening during that period of time. So I don't think it's that much of a surprise that the volumes went down during that period. Secondly, of course, they didn't have access to Australian wines. And we were the largest exporters of wine into China pre-COVID, for whatever reason. The Chinese palate is very similar to the Australian palate. They like those big, bold red wines. I know that because the Trade Minister himself told me that he loved big, bold Australian red wines. And they haven't been able to buy them. So it's no surprise that wine consumption has gone down, because the product that they really like hasn't been on the supermarket shelves. So I think even though there has been a bit of a decline in the wine market overall over there, I think the resumption of trade from Australia will very quickly increase.
And so you've been here in the region this week. Why has it taken so long, though, for a federal minister to come out with the region in crisis? And where's your federal counterpart, Murray Watt, the agriculture minister?
Oh, look, Murray, I sit next to Murray in the Senate. He's very focused on the issues that the Riverland is currently facing. I was keen to make sure that when I came, I had something to tell the local community. So I've been waiting patiently for the resumption of the wine trade into China. I wanted to come up personally myself and tell the community what I thought the future looked like with the resumption of that trade. So I was invited by the local winemakers and grape growers. I assured them that I would be here. I used to work up here before in my current job. I was in the Riverland for 10 years as a union organiser, so I'm very familiar with the region. I've watched, like everybody else, some of the terrible things that have occurred in the region with the floods, the issues around the pandemic, and of course the wine issues with China. I wanted to come here when I had some, I think, good news, so that I can give a positive message to the Riverland community. I think that's what I've done in the last couple of days.
And of course, we've predominantly spoken about wine, but before I let you go, of course, with the rock lobster, it's still a commodity that's having trouble getting back into China, and it seems to have been quite slow. You know, is there any progress on this?
Yes, unfortunately, we've not been able to determine the order in which the Chinese government deals with the lifting of these impediments. I've now met with my Chinese counterpart on 6 occasions, and on every occasion I raised the issue of lobster, and it was a big trade, about $700 million worth of trade a year, so it was a significant trade. I'm confident that all of the bans will be removed, and we will get our wonderful lobsters back into the Chinese market. I'm having further discussions with my Chinese counterpart next week Lobster will be the number one issue on the table for discussion. So I haven't forgotten about it. The Chinese Trade Minister understands we want the restrictions on lobster lifted, and I have to say I'm confident that they will be.
That is the Federal Trade and Tourism Minister, Don Farrell. They're speaking with Eliza Berlage in the Riverland today. It's just going on 15 minutes to one.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, midway through World War II, it was pretty clear that the war would not be ending quickly and that Australia desperately needed to keep its farms and primary industries operating. And thus, the Australian Women's Land Army was born. Thousands of women across Australia answered the call. Author and researcher Victoria Perman based one of her novels around the work that women did helping to feed Australia during World War II.
I didn't know Australia had a women's land army during World War II. I knew vaguely that the UK had set up land armies in World War I and II, but it wasn't until I was researching a previous book that I came across, I love looking at old newspapers, and I came across an article about a women's land army. And I thought, if I don't know about the Australian women who gave up their city lives and went to the country, then surely I can't be alone. So that set me off down the rabbit hole of discovering the really important role that these women played in World War II in actually keeping our troops and the country fed.
Well, we often hear about the land armies in the UK, et cetera, but we did the same kind of thing here, what, sort of midway through the Second World War?
Yeah, the land army began in 1942. I think when people started to realise the war was going to go on, and you know, hundreds of thousands of men had enlisted to serve, 990,000 Australians, in fact. So there was a big shortage in the agricultural industries. So it wasn't just about feeding Australians. It was about supplying all those foodstuffs for the troops as well. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people needed feeding. So the federal government, reluctantly at first, and some of the agricultural organisations, I must say, were reluctant at first to establish such a thing, but they had no choice, actually. They were desperately in need of workers. So in 1942, the Land Army was created and 6,000 women signed up.
They advertised? Do you know if there was some sort of campaign?
They did advertise, yes. Yeah. They advertised, and there were beautiful ads in the women's magazines. I used the Women's Weekly ads at the time, which portrayed the life of a land girl as energetic and healthy and outdoors. And they were the best kind of propaganda, in a sense, that they were women doing country things in the fresh air, and it all looked fantastic. And for some of them, it was that life, but it was hard work, as anyone who farms or, you know, has property in the regions would know.
What sort of women applied to become part of the land army?
They were women from the cities, office workers, those who were doing clerical work, shop assistants, who wanted that big adventure. And some were motivated by that sense of adventure. Others were motivated because they had family who had enlisted, many in their families had enlisted, and they too wanted to do their bit. I did read about one land girl who was so angry that her brother had been given a white feather, which, you know, was a sign of cowardice. And men, for a whole range of reasons, couldn't enlist. Perhaps they're in essential services back here in Australia, or perhaps they had a disability that might not have been obvious to others. But, yeah, there was white feathers being handed out. And she was so furious at this, she decided to enlist in the land army. So they had all kinds of reasons, really. But I think, you know, 66,000 women in Australia
wow.
signed up for in branches of the women's services. Yeah, and some were nurses right on the front lines in hospital ships. But there were other women who gave up their comfortable lives and put on overalls and
moved out to the country.
Moved out to the country. All over Australia, from, you know, picking cotton in Queensland to working in apple orchards in Tassie, picking cherries in South Australia and oranges in Gosford. They worked everywhere there was a need for agricultural labour.
And that's the sort of things they did? They harvested. Do you know, have you heard any other stories?
They did. They harvested all kinds of crops. They drove tractors to plough fields. Some actually worked as technical assistants in the forerunner of the CSIRO. They did everything that was necessary. And a story that I particularly loved was when flax supplies dried up from Europe because of obviously the war, the English government worked with the Australian government to plant flax. Flax, as we know, makes linen, and that linen thread was used for parachutes and shoelaces and all kinds of things. So Australia created a flax industry, and wow. Women were needed to work there, and it was hard work.
And so they kept these, well, they started that one, but they kept a lot of primary industries going through the war. So quite vital, some of that work.
They certainly did. And I've set my book, The Land Girls, partly in Mildura, because Mildura had per head the highest enlistment rate in the country. And I thought that was a really interesting place to set the book because it was the hub of the dried fruits industry. So the dried fruits were not only important for people at home, but they were in ration packs. Dried sultanas were in ration packs for the boys who were away. And anyone who made a fruitcake to send to a loved one had dried fruit in it. So I had my characters go up to Mildura to work in that industry. But women were doing everything.
That's spuds, fantastic. Yeah.
Apples, pears, beans, grapes, cotton, everything.
And they did this during the war. Do you have any sense of how they went after the war, whether some women, you know, went back to the home or they stayed in primary industries?
The Land Army was officially disbanded at the very end of 1945, 31st of December, and they all lost their jobs. Some of them went back to their lives, but I sensed a real a sense of adventure that had been that had flourished in them. And I listened to oral histories of women who served in the Land Army. It gave them an independence they hadn't had before. They're away from home, away from the strictures of life at that time. They were living with other young women, and I mean, although it was hard work, I'm sure that would have been tremendous fun, a bit like going on camp. A couple of women bought a farm and decided to stay in the country. Another couple of women I read decided to take a trip around New Zealand in a car they bought in New Zealand. And I thought, when I was researching the book, I thought these must have been really unusual pursuits for women of that era, when our assumption is that they all went back home and the boys came home and women went back to the kitchens and so on. And some women said, I like this working thing, I'm not giving it up. So they went into other, back to their professions or picked up, you know, permanent work. I met one Land Army girl who was a real treat, and I asked her, after the war, did you quit work altogether and raise your kids? And she said, no, we couldn't afford to. It took two incomes to afford a mortgage.
As author and researcher Victoria Perman, who based one of her novels around the work women did helping to feed Australia during World War II, she was speaking there to Fiona Breen. Well, finally today, how much do you know about the story behind Australia's Light Horse Brigade? The Mounted Infantry originally formed in 1888 in Wagga Wagga, New South Wales. Mick Batchelor is a member of the Riverina Light Horse Troop, and he travels around Australia to keep the memory alive, attending ceremonies dressed in World War I uniform and riding his horses to reenact the light horse tradition. Well, Lily McEwer caught up with Mick as he passed through Broken Hill yesterday on his way to Tibooburra for this morning's Anzac Day ceremony.
We've got five horses, four riders. So in the light horse, four riders is a pretty important number because that's what they call a section. And the light horse used to operate in a section. That was a fighting unit and a good way to manage your horses together. Group of four.
How did you get involved with this and training the light horse?
Always had an interest in the history because my father being a World War II veteran, and he was in the light horse prior to the start of World War II before they disbanded it, and he always spoke fondly of it. And then I sort of got involved with him in his later life, helping him in March, like Anzac Day in a march, sort of like a carer. And then I thought, well, I could do better than this. When my dad passed away, I thought I'd still march for him, but I'd like to do it on a horse and represent the light horse tradition. So I got in contact with the Australian Light Horse Association at the time. The president was Phil Chalker, And then they steered me in the right direction to get the right equipment. And then we formed our own troop, which we call the Riverina Light Horse Troop, which is based at Wagga, but it's made up of members from around the Riverina. We travel and do our local shows and things, but we also go further afield. Last year, our troop went up to Darwin Royal Show and Catherine, Alice Springs. And this year, we're not all going, but I'm heading back up there to do the Northern Territory show run. And I think I've got a bit of work to do around some of the schools and communities up there with the Light Horse.
What was the role of a Light Horseman within the war?
Well, everyone thinks that the Light Horseman's like a cavalry. The Light Horse was mounted infantry. The reason they were on horses was to save them foot slogging, and which meant they could get from A to B a lot quicker than an infantry man on foot. So the horses were actually only for transport. They weren't there for fighting off the back of. On a rare occasion, they did do a charge. Was at Bathsheba, that everyone knows the charge of Bathsheba, and that's where the Turks made a mistake, thinking that they'll come in so far and then dismount for action. But they didn't dismount, and they kept going. And that actually wasn't the last charge that the Australian Light Horse did. A little bit later than that, they did a me. And that was officially the last charge that they did. But like I say, usually it was just a form of transport horse, and the fighting was still on the ground, but the horse would get you there quicker than foot slogging.
How important is it to remember the horses that were involved in the war and the Light Horsemen?
Well, in World War One, for an example, over 160,000 horses left Australia, and only one came back, and that was General Bridges' horse Sandy. Dying wish was that his horse, favourite horse, be returned back to Australia for his funeral, because they did take his body back home. Most people got buried overseas, but his body did come back, and that horse did come back. It's a whole story on its own, but that was the only horse out of 160,000 horses that left Australia that came back. And also, there was over 160,000 mules come out of Australia that went overseas too for service, and none of them came back. One of the horses we've got, he came off Narioko Station, and I like using him for a good reference, as in he's a Kidman and Co. bred horse. Like most people know the story of Sid Kidman, and he became Sir Sidney Kidman after World War One because of his great donations of horses for their war effort that earned him a knighthood. And so I always like to tell the story of Dietz. He's got the SK brand on his shoulder. He come off Narioko Station when Kidman and Co. sold out to Gina Reinhardt, and a lot of these excess horses were all on their way to Peterborough to the Knackery. Anyway, I was at Tipperborough for the rodeo, and they were selling these horses there, and I was talking to a young fella there, knew them all, and I told him what I wanted to use this horse for, and he said, "I know just the one." So he introduced me to Dietz, and now Dietz has done a fair bit of travelling around, and yeah, a lot better than being in the can of dog food.
And how is it for you as well to be involved in these, you know, Anzac Day ceremonies and with your horses?
Very special moment. Everyone's a bit different because they've all got different speeches that people do, but get down to basics of it. It's a very emotional time doing it. Yeah, nearly gets a tear to the eye every time.
Mick Batchelor from the Riverina Light Horse Troop speaking to Lily McCure. Mick had his story told on Landline last year. Don't forget you can go and catch up on anything you've missed on Landline on ABC iView.
Hi there, Lisa Miller here. Isn't it great to get outside for a breath of fresh air? It's one of life's simple pleasures, right? Well, I can help you to keep something else simple too, finding news you can trust. You can stay in the know with ABC News. Download the app and receive alerts to your phone. Visit the ABC News website. And for stories straight to your inbox, subscribe to one of our newsletters. It's all the latest, all verified, all the time. Stay in the know with ABC News.
And don't forget, you can keep across all the latest rural news on our website, abc.net.au/rural. And you can catch up on anything you've missed on the Country Hour on the ABC Listen app. It's a free app. You can go download it onto your smartphone or tablet right now if you haven't. There's a lot of great content on there while you go digging around as well. But look for South Australian Country Hour while you're at it and pop us on as one of your favourites. Thank you so much for your company today. I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour. It's just coming on time for the 1 o'clock news.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone, search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.